From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The recent shootdown of a Syrian Arab Army jet by U.S. forces and the firing of missiles by Iran into Syria indicate a heightening of tensions inside that country with the potential to bring conflict between the U.S. and Russia, among others. For more on that, we spoke with senior lecturer at Moscow State University, Mark Sloboda, who's also a retired U.S. naval officer, via Skype from Moscow Wednesday. Mark, a lot more going on in Syria, a couple real incidents that were troubling as hell.
Yeah, Don, thanks for having me. It's always good to be on CPR. There is an extremely tense conflict situation going on in East Syria at the moment. There is a war for maneuver going on. I think the first thing one has to understand is that ISIS is no longer an offensive threat to anyone, not in Iraq, not in Syria, maybe to the Syrian army garrison that is defending the provincial capital of Deir ez-Zor, where they've held out against ISIS siege for over 4 years now, defending 100,000 civilians there. That is the only potential place where ISIS could lash out in its death throes with any real effect. Yeah. But ISIS is crumbling everywhere.
Yeah, they're no more rolling over the horizon in brand new SUVs ready to capture your country.
No, it's not happening. They're folding in Iraq. They're under siege in Mosul. They're surrounded in Raqqa, and the Syrian army has seized 1,400 square kilometers from them in just over the last week. So they're folding up everywhere. If anything, well, for quite some time now, the biggest terrorist threat in Syria has been Al Qaeda. That's probably been true for over a year now. Perhaps it was always true to some extent. They've been battling the Syrian government. They lost in Aleppo. They lost control of East Aleppo. They've lost in several other areas in central and western Syria. Now they're pretty much contained, Al Qaeda and their friends, to two areas, Idlib province, which they almost entirely control, but is a hilly, mountainous region without much industry, without much strategic importance. The only important thing about it is it has a mountainous border, not very convenient for supplies, but still possible with Turkey. And that's how Al-Qaeda and its friends are supplied there. But they're largely self-contained there in Idlib province and in Daraa. And they're kept busy at the moment, one by Turkey, which is hesitating with its proxies what to do next, and two, because the two big other financial backers of the various Al-Qaeda and friends, 31 flavors of jihad, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, are in the midst of a very loud and public domestic squabble.
Even at home in Saudi Arabia, we see this morning. Just before we go in any deeper, let's just take a moment to give credit where credit's due, so people understand exactly what's been happening there. The routing essentially of ISIS and the containment at a minimum of Al Qaeda. You have the Syrian army, this dictator's group of captured people that's been fighting essentially now for 6 years. Routing all of these characters supplied by almost the entire Western international community, quote unquote, Russia lending air support, and Iran and Hezbollah offering support in various ways. That is what has enabled the takedown of ISIS and Al-Qaeda in this area, and not the United States and its allies dropping bombs essentially on the Syrian army.
Yeah, this is you know, this has been the so far the at least strategic victory so far over 50,000 foreign jihadis, which have flooded Syria, along with, of course, a large number of the domestic variety. And these are all pretty much Salafists to Islamists. But, you know, that pretty much explains entirely who the rebel force is and has always been. What the resulting of this Saudi Qatari domestic squabble means that right now is that Al-Qaeda and their splinter group Ahrar al-Sham and groups on either side are now actually fighting each other in Idlib. And so this, along with these deconfliction zone arrangements, however imperfect, that have been reached with Turkey, who is the enemy, is has been backing them, but has its own concerns with the U.S. switch to very strong support for the Kurds and their worry about what this means in terms of a Kurdish autonomous or even independent state on their border, means that they're very dissatisfied with the way this has all played out and the way they've been dragged into it by the U.S. So they're not encouraging Al-Qaeda and friends to go on any massive offensive. This frees up lots of Syrian and allied troops for the big push east. And this is what we have in East Syria now, is a war for maneuver. The game is not just defeating ISIS, because that's a foregone conclusion. The game is taking territory and resources, strategic roads, strategic population centers. When ISIS gives them up, who controls them? Are they controlled by the Syrian government, which quite obviously wants to take back as much of its territory as it can, if not all of it, or the U.S. proxies in the east? And the U.S. proxies in the east consist of two separate groups. The by far the largest and most important is the Syrian Democratic Forces, as they're quite euphemistically called. This is 90-95% Kurdish YPG, leftist YPG, which their ally Turkey regards as NATO ally Turkey regards as terrorists, but they're at least largely secular. The Pentagon has been working with them for some time. They've actually fought numerous battles against the CIA-backed Islamist Free Syrian Army. They've been fighting the Islamist rebels and ISIS for years now, and expanding south, and they've currently got Raqqa under siege. They've also got about 5% local Arab Sunni tribes. This is how they try to present them, as not just being Kurds, but the Syrian Democratic Forces, even though that these handful of tribes really represent only icing on the cake, a token presence, if you will, a branding more than anything else. But the problem with the Kurds expanding any further than they have south in East Syria is they've already gone beyond the limits of Kurdish ethnic majority areas. They are now in Sunni Arab majority areas, and they're not popular with Sunni Arabs. And so it's very difficult to justify or have territory turned over in any type of even medium term to them. So this is why they haven't been a great partner for partition. Also, it has to be said, the Kurds are not a monolith, and there are lots of Kurdish forces, including other elements of the YPG, that have been long cooperating with the Syrian government and the Russians, receiving supplies, close air support, cooperating for the transfer of territory to the Syrian government in order to prevent further Turkish incursions and seizure of territory, which perhaps even the U.S. Agreed to on those occasions. But the Kurds have largely refrained from fighting against the government under enormous Western pressure for years. Now it appears that with an end game coming, at least those Kurds that are involved with the Syrian Democratic Forces are moving a little bit more to the U.S. side. That's not entirely clear at this point. But of course, the Kurds are out for their own interests. You know, they want as much autonomy or whatever they can get from this. The problem is for any autonomous or, you know, even independent Kurdish state that we can talk of theoretically, is they would be surrounded on all sides by enemies with no sea access. All of the surrounding countries, Turkey, Iraq, Syria, Iran, all have Kurdish minorities of their own, which they don't want to give up territory to, and will highly frown on any even Kurdish autonomous zone, much less an independent state, which no one would accept. Yeah. So the Kurds really have to play a smart end game here to maximize their returns in terms of autonomy and self-government, while recognizing that they're not going to get a full independent state because no one in the region is willing to give it to them.
Yeah, you know, you have you mentioned some of these contradictions too. Mm-hmm. You have Kurds, for example, that range from the Barzanis in northern Iraq, who are essentially, we're Kurds, we're the mafia, the oil here is ours, yeah. Give me $1 billion, thank you, Turkey.
Allied with Turkey, yes, right. Turkish military bases on what is a de facto Kurdish mafia state in northern Iraq, which is actually opposed to the Kurdish YPG, right, in Syria.
Then you have Kurds in Iran, as you mentioned. You have Kurds in Turkey, Iraq, and mm-hmm. Syria. And so this Kurdistan, to the extent it would be constructed to the full reach of Kurdish ethnic majority, would be ripped out of three or four countries, all of which, of course, have their own feelings about how that works. And if you consider the situation as complex as it is now, the internal situation as complex as it would be given the forces of YPG, the KPP, yes, the Barzanis, etc. Yeah. You have, for example, looking at the part that comes out of Iran, yeah, the U.S. and its people using that as a way to make mischief inside Iran, sure, likewise for everybody else in different places. So that, yeah, complexity is just one small corner of the complex picture on the ground in Syria and Iraq and elsewhere in the region.
Absolutely. The Kurds are not a monolith. They're not in agreement. None of the surrounding states would allow to this. So the Kurds have got to play – the Kurds in Syria in particular we're talking here have to play their cards right. And there is, of course, a recent U.S. history of the U.S. throwing the Kurds under the bush in northern Iraq in multiple ways, multiple times.
Right. Playing their cards right there meant 52 pickup, in essence.
Yeah. So anyway, it's difficult for the Kurds to expand any further south. So they're not really a good partition partner. Right. And we have to assume that the United States at this point, with their land grab of territory and attacks on the Syrian government, intends to try to seize East Syria or what of it they can. Now, East Syria is very low population-wise. It is desert crisscrossed, but by a few major highways. But the important thing about it is that it would be at least some form of barrier, how effective that would be, between Iran and a heavily Shia influenced or dominant Iraq, which seems to be allying more with Russia and Syria these days than with the U.S. government, and a pro Iranian Syrian government and Hezbollah. This arc of Shiite influence, which the neocons in Saudi and Israel fear so much, yeah, because it challenges their hegemony of the Middle East. Now, never mind that, of course, this arc was created by the U.S. Right. Invasion and removal of Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
Oops.
Blowback there. Yeah, oops. Well, now they're trying to clean up their own mess. Of course, this is all on the way to eventual conflict with Iran. Whether they want to actually form a partitioned East Syria as a Sunnistan or a Salafistan or whatever you want to call it, or whether they just want to seize as much to use and leverage in final settlement negotiations, it doesn't really make that much of a difference because they have no legitimacy to be doing it. And worse than that, they have no real strategy for it. They don't have enough boots on the ground. Right. The Kurds, like I said, are not – their simply ethnicity and their political disposition makes them ill-suited to occupy Sunni Arab dominant eastern Syria. Right. Now, in the south, the very southeast of Syria, there is a U.S. military base illegally occupying Syrian territory at Al-Tanf. And this is right across the border from Jordan and very close to the border with Iraq. It's in the very, very, very quarter southeast. Now, there's about 150 U.S. troops there, supposedly, along with British troops, probably Jordan and Syria as well, and some Norwegian troops for whatever reason. We can't, you know, it's hard to fathom, but they're there as well. And they've been attempting to do again what the U.S. has failed for the last 6 years of proxy war on Syria to do, is to manufacture, to train up an indigenous Sunni moderate rebel force. And in every time they've done this, they've ended up with jihadis that join Al-Qaeda, that join ISIS, that just disappear, that have no ability. Al-Tanf is where we, right across the border in Jordan, is where we've had some rebels that some military special forces were training go full jihadi and then launch themselves suicide attackers against the U.S. Special forces that were training them. And I've heard plenty of people who have friends in the special forces. I'm ex-military myself, that the U.S. special forces have never and are not happy about being tasked with training these guys, because they're well aware of who and what they are. But this new Syrian army, as it's been termed, hasn't been able to turn out much again. So they don't really have any type of even proxy boots on the ground, Sunni Arabs, that would be required to hold territory in East Syria. So without that, without the Kurds being possible to do this, without any new Syrian army force, and without putting something like 150,000 U.S. troops on the ground in East Syria, the U.S. has really run out of options. And Russia is basically trying to avoid conflict, going to the most ridiculous extreme lengths to avoid conflict, no matter what illegality and insanity the U.S. gets up to in East Syria, right. Because by their thinking, the U.S. has already strategically lost, and they're waiting for the U.S. to recognize that fact. And to give up the game, trying to save some face, perhaps with a shared victory announcement over ISIS or what have you. But Russia is waiting for the U.S. to recognize that they've lost this war for maneuver. Most recently, the U.S. was attacking any Syrian government forces moving east, going anywhere near this Al-Tanf base. This is where we've seen a lot of the airstrikes against the Syrian government in the last month. Syrian government, and it has to be said, they're actually attacking Iraqis too. Iraqi Shiite militias, often trained and sometimes led by Iran, that are assisting the Syrian government in the area. They're actually the U.S.'s allies fighting ISIS in Iraq. But on the other side of the border in Syria, they're being attacked by the U.S. So, again, this contradictory U.S. strategy, it's failed for years now. That there are no moderates for them to work with. They're allied with Al-Qaeda. They're angering Turkey. They're angering Iraq. This has really been a disaster. Strategically, in so many ways, it started with Obama. It continues on with Trump, with no even real goal. The neocons, which there are a few in the Trump administration and more outside of it, they desperately not only want, they can't get regime change anymore. That's already been taken off the table, at least for the time being. If they can't get that, they want partition of East Syria, and they want war with Iran. And since Trump took office and spoke of ending regime change wars and détente with Russia, they have tried to sell Trump on this partition in East Syria, not as against the Syrian government and not as against Russia, but as against Iranian influence. Right. in Syria. And that is something that plays much better with the Trump administration, which has more than a few individuals who are already anti-Iranian, pro-Israeli war hawks.
Yeah, he's been throwing, you know, concessions, at least, you know, in terms of rhetoric and some of his appointments. I mean, Flint was about as rabid as you get anti-Iranian. Yeah. But policy-wise, of course, it does conflict. I just want to point something out and maybe come back out for 1 second, because you used the S word, strategic. And, you know, let's talk for a second about the big power games here. We're talking, road and, string of pearls and, pipelines and all that stuff, because we got strategically placed real estate here in terms of, transit points between China and Russia on the one hand, or particularly China, and Europe and Africa on the other.
Yeah, I mean, it has long been assumed, and there have been multiple plans, and people have tried to argue against it. But I think the idea that the U.S. has always been in favor, one of the main reasons they're involved here is other than stopping this arc of Shia influence and other than a prelude to attacking Iran, what they've been doing in Syria is trying to install pipelines, gas pipelines that would run from Qatar up through Syria, Turkey, and then on to Europe. Partly because of course, this aids their strong ally, Qatar, major gas producer. Qatar has the largest U.S. military base in the Middle East, perhaps the world, that is used to control the region, the airbase and U.S. airbase in Qatar. But on top of that, they want to reduce Europe's energy dependence, interdependence with Russia as a way of weakening Russia and reducing Russian influence on Europe. At many times, they seem far more keen to do this than the Europeans are themselves. And this pipeline remains a pipe dream. But I have no doubt that if the Syrian government would have fallen, and the Syrian government did deny this pipeline, which Qatar wanted to build, then we would see this pipeline built, or at least, try to be built in a much more serious way. And with a partition of East Syria, this cuts through the heavily oil-producing areas of Syria as well. This is where they are in East Syria, in these largely unoccupied deserts, especially around Deir ez-Zor. That they would try to run these pipelines through East Syria and into Turkey then as well, if they couldn't get Damascus. And so that remains a possibility. So the neocons have been trying to sell Trump on this. In particular, Foreign Policy reported last week from anonymous officials again that there are two particular individuals on the National Security Council, Ezra Cohen Warwick, who is the Senior Director for Intelligence on the NSC, and Derek Harvey, who is National Security Council's top Middle East advisor. They're the ones pushing for conflict with Iran and everyone else, because that's what it would entail, the Syrian government, Russia, right. The whole shebang in eastern Syria. Now, supposedly against them, according to this article in Foreign Policy anyway, we have Mattis, McMasters, Dunford, General Dunford, who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and perhaps Brett McGurk, who is the U.S. diplomat in charge of the anti-ISIS or what it's supposed to be, coalition. They want the U.S. supposedly to concentrate on fighting ISIS and worry about what comes after later. The problem with that is we're already there. We're already in a post-ISIS scenario, and the game is who takes territory. And this puts, Russia and the U.S. in direct conflict in East Syria. And someone has got to give. And it really matters more to the Syrian government and Russia. It's far more strategic to both of them, of course, than it is to the United States. And especially with the Trump administration that is sending mixed signals everywhere. So with this base down there, what the Syrian army did in the past 10 days now is jet across these highways with a blitzkrieg and just instead of trying to confront this base, just loop around it and effectively boxing in and cutting it off from any advance further north in Syria, mm. unless they want to engage in open warfare with the Syrian government and Russia, who at least has advisors out there with them. So it was just a good strategic play. They surrounded them. They didn't try to confront. They just surrounded. They met at the Iraqi border with the Iraqis, who were very happy to see them. And they've cut off this base from the rest of Syria, preventing any, even minuscule as it is, new Syrian army march north to meet the other U.S. proxies, the Kurds in North Syria. Now, the key to controlling East Syria, again, these highways are important. There's a highway just north of Al-Tanf that goes all the way from Baghdad to Damascus. It's a vital artery for the region. The oil supplies are there, but the city, the provincial capital of Deir ez-Zor, is the largest urban population center out there. It's very strategically placed. The Syrian government has held it for years under ISIS siege. The U.S. would like to see it fall. They would like to see it fall to ISIS. And to that effect, they have been encouraging ISIS to escape from Raqqa, where they're under siege by the SDF and have been holding on for some time, it must be said, and then to move into Deir ez-Zor, where hopefully they would finally overrun the city and the Syrian military base there that protects it. And even Anne Barnard at the New York Times, okay, as pro-rebel as you can get while still maintaining a token bit of objectivity, last week even she said there are signs that to take Raqqa without an all-out fight, they will let more ISIS escape to the south with the intention to fight and follow to Deir ez-Zor. So they would want they're probably, if not just allowing them, perhaps even negotiating with them to give up Raqqa without a fight, to move south, to take Deir ez-Zor, which eventually they would then take from ISIS and claim that they had liberated it as the capital of East Syria. This hasn't worked out the way they've wanted. The most recent, the shooting down of the Syrian bomber, was over a strategically placed town, with the Syrian government making this loop to the south to cut off Al-Tanf. The U.S. wanted the Syrian Democratic Forces to loop south of Raqqa, cutting off the Syrian army from ending the siege on Deir ez-Zor by ISIS. So they tried to cut off the Syrian army from advancing. This was a vital town there, Jadin, one more along the route. Now, the U.S. narrative says that the Syrian government, the bomber, attacked Kurdish, or supposedly Kurdish, SDF forces there anyway. Now, the problem with this narrative, and that's why they shot down the bomber, they were collective self-defense. Not that there is collective self-defense under international law for a non-state actor, but collective self-defense of an anti-ISIS coalition partner. That's how they justified this.
In Syria, without authorization of the government or the Security Council, by the way. Yeah, illegally,
without the Security Council, right. Without the invitation in Syrian airspace, right. on Syrian territory. But there is no evidence that the SDF had ever taken this town. They made no announcement from it. In fact, earlier, less than 24 hours earlier, it was the Syrian government who announced they had taken Jadin from ISIS. And they say that they were pursuing an ISIS convoy in the area, which was trying to flee from Raqqa into Deir ez-Zor, and that's what they were attacking. Now, even the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is one lone pro-rebel propagandist in London, Abdul Rahman, who is paid by the British government and others to do what he does. Even the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the U.S. Version is wrong, that the town was held by the Syrian government, that the SDF had never reached it, and that the Syrian government was indeed fighting ISIS, when, you know, the U.S. fighter shot down this bomber. And this is because they didn't want the Syrian government advancing any further. It was a warning. Well, this warning didn't work. The Russia, you know, other than some rhetoric and this ending of deconfliction agreement again with the United States, and they went a little bit further this time and said that they would track and regard as potential targets any aircraft, meaning any U.S. coalition aircraft as well, flying west of the Euphrates. But they didn't do anything else. They continued to advance on and take Rasafa, which is the next key city there. And they've pretty much secured their ability to advance into Deir ez-Zor, but also to cut off any potentially cut off any ISIS forces trying to flee Raqqa into Deir ez-Zor.
Mark, we appreciate it as always.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.